without me even telling you what they are. Super simple this morning, and we're only going to cover 7 verses. But we're continuing, obviously, with our study of 1 Peter. We'll talk a little bit about the context of where we've come from as we go through this. The very first word of our text this morning begins with the word likewise. In my translation, the English Standard Version, and if you start reading and you got the word likewise, you go, well, I don't know what likewise means unless I know what just came before it. So we're going to get there. We're going to get there in just a minute about the context. So the context is critically important for understanding this text. This lesson, verses 1 through 7, Peter is addressing first wives and then husbands. And what I want to do is we're going to, kind of take one at a time and read a little bit of it and then come back and talk about it. So let's begin with the first part, talking about, and again, you're filling the blank, super, super difficult to come up with, is wives. He says, likewise, and again, we're going to come back to that, wives, be subject to your own husbands, so that even if some do not obey the word, they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. Now let's talk about that word likewise. Peter has been talking about in what we know of as chapter 2. And I say this a lot. You have to remember that when this was written, there were no chapters. There were no verses. This was a letter, right? And so the topic largely has not changed from what he was talking about at the end of chapter 2. And the second half of chapter 2, Peter has been talking about Christians dealing with different groups of people in the world. Okay? So the first group, if you go back to the middle of the chapter, he talks about Christians dealing with, and the word he uses is Gentiles. And we talked about how Gentile there just simply means a pagan, one who is not converted to Christianity. And so Peter gives instructions on, if you're a Christian and you're dealing with Gentiles or pagans, how do you treat them? And he tells them, treat them with honor, honorably. And then the second group is those human institutions, which is similar to what Paul said in Romans 13, talking about governing authorities. When you are dealing with the powers of government, he even uses the examples of the emperor and the governor. How do you deal with them? And he says, be subject to them, meaning put yourself in willful submission to those in power. And then the third group is, he talks about masters. And not just any masters, but he says masters who treat you unjustly. And what does he say about those masters who treat you unjustly? He also says, be subject to them, meaning put yourself in willful submission to them. So you're a Christian, you're dealing with pagans, you're dealing with powers who could be, powers of authority who could be corrupt, you're dealing with masters who could be punishers who are punishing you unjustly. And in every case, it's show them honor, show them respect, be in subjection to them. And so he begins in what we know of as chapter 3 with the word likewise when talking about wives and their relationship with their husbands. Okay? And he uses the same phrase that he uses when talking about human institutions and in talking about masters. He says, be subject, in this case, to your own husbands. And I put on the right a note, same thing. Means to place in subordination to. But there's a difference between the relationship between a wife and a husband and a slave and a master. This is a willful submission. I've got at the very top of the page, and I'm not going to take the time to go to all these because we'd be here all day, and many of you would say we're here all day anyway when I preach. Right, Jeremy? Yep. But at the very top, I've got, compare this to Ephesians 5, Colossians 3, 1 Timothy 2, Titus 2. So specifically Ephesians 5 and Colossians 3, written by Paul, talking about how husbands and wives mutually submit to each other. Each has a responsibility in a marriage relationship. And And that is a willful acceptance of those responsibilities. Okay? It's a willful acceptance of those responsibilities. We have to remember in the greater context of Scripture that while when we read about, you know, what Paul has to say about the relationships in marriage, what Peter has to say, it's clearly a patriarchal structure where the husband is the head of the household. But we must never lose sight, though, that both have responsibilities in a marriage, critical responsibilities in a marriage, and also that both husband and wife are fellow heirs of the grace of God. And we're going to talk more about that in just a minute when we get down to verse 7 talking about husbands. We're both fellow heirs. We're in this together. This is a partnership where we willfully submit to each other. We willfully have responsibilities to each other. But the specific situation here is a little different than what Paul presents in Ephesians 5 and in Colossians 3. Because what's the situation here? He says, be subject to your own husbands, so that if even if some do not obey the word. So again, I put a little note underneath that in bold. Remember the context. The second half of chapter 2 was all about Christians living out their salvation in a hostile world. Which again, that hostility could be in dealing with pagans, in dealing with governing authorities, in dealing with masters, where you're dealing with the hostility of those who have not been converted to your belief. And so now here Peter is dealing with the very, very real possibility that you could be a wife in a marriage relationship where you have decided to follow Christ and your husband has not. And could that create conflict? Could that create a hostile situation? Absolutely. Absolutely. There can be, even today, conflict in a marriage where you have differing beliefs. And so Peter is dealing with the very real possibility here that you may have a wife in these Gentile cities in the Roman province of Galatia that he's writing to that have been converted, but their husbands have not. By the way, when I look at this and I say, well, there's 7 verses. 6 of them deal with wives, 1 deal with husbands. I believe the reason why is because it was way more likely then that you would have a wife who was converted and a husband who was not than a husband who was converted and a wife who was not. Because of, the structure of that society, it was less likely that a wife would not follow their husband because, let me tell you, in those times, wives had no rights. They had no rights. You know, they had virtually the same rights as children and slaves, which is to say, they had no rights. And so just the idea that a husband has responsibility at all was a revolutionary concept. And you go back to the writings of Paul, like in Ephesians 5, where he said they're mutually to submit to each other. That's a whole different way of thinking than the culture. So again, why is he dealing 6 verses here, what we would consider verses? Because again, that's the more likely scenario that a wife has decided to follow Christ, the husband is still a pagan. And so you go back to, what did he say, how you deal with Gentiles, how you deal with pagans? You show them honor, right? And so the question is, well, what if I'm in a marriage where my husband has not decided to follow Christ, what do I do? He says, if your husband does not obey the word, he says, be subject to them so that they may be won without a word by the conduct of their wives. And then he says, when they see your respectful and pure conduct. And I made a note there that said the wife's conduct should be a testament to the salvation she has received. He says, again, if you're in a marriage situation where your husband is not a believer and you are, live out your salvation. Show your respect. Show your submission. Live a pure life. Why? So that, maybe they'll be won over. Now you remember he said the same thing when dealing with Gentiles back in chapter 2. So that on the day of visitation, that they may be found holy. Same thing. You may win them with your example. Okay? So that's the instruction. Live it out. Continue to live out your salvation even if your husband does not believe. Does that make sense? Make sense? Okay. So live out your salvation. Then we get to verses 3 and 4. which I offered several people to teach this instead of me, and they all declined. That was supposed to be funny. You guys have not read ahead, apparently. But anyway, Sam has been asking me week after week if he could preach one of the sermons in the Faithful Amidst the Fire series. I was like, I got the perfect one for you. You do this one. Anyway, again, that was supposed to be funny. Man, I'm just throwing them out there, and it's just flailing on the floor. Okay, anyway. So here's the next two verses. He says, do not let your adorning be external, the braiding of hair and the putting on of gold, jewelry, or the clothing you wear. But let your adorning be the hidden person of the heart with the imperishable beauty of a gentle and quiet spirit, which is God's, in God's sight, is very precious. Now, I'm going to approach these verses from a couple of different directions, and then I'm going to come back to high level, what's he saying? Okay, you with me? Man, I got no response to that either. You guys still with me? You sound like you were awake. Okay, so the first thing I want to look at is the construction of this, especially verse 3. Okay, he says, do not let your adorning be external. So the question is, and then three examples are braiding of hair, putting on of gold jewelry, or the clothing you wear. So the question is this a prohibition from external adorning for wives? Okay, that's the context, right? Wives. And those specific examples. The phrase, do not let your adorning be external. The first thing I want to note is that this cannot be an absolute prohibition. Why? Well, just common sense says, because one of the three is what? Clothing. Are women prohibited from wearing clothing? No, no one would think that, right? So just at the top level, if you know nothing about the structure or the grammar or the Greek or whatever, you go, it can't be an absolute prohibition because clothing is one of the three things, right? Okay, everybody got that? Is this BS? You still with me? Yeah. So it cannot be that. But I want to talk a little bit deeper than that, okay? This phrase, do not let your adorning be external, is the type of phrase when worded by someone of Jewish background. Who wrote this? Peter. What is Peter by nationality, by race? He's a Jew. Okay? This is called a Hebraism. Okay? A Hebraism. And I've given you a definition of Hebraism underneath that verse. A term to describe a feature of the Hebrew language when used in another language. This was written in Greek. This was written in Greek. But what is Peter's background? He's a Jew, probably grew up speaking Hebrew, maybe Aramaic, but writing in Greek because that's the language of the day, right? When we came out of the Greek Empire into the Roman Empire, Greek is the language of the day. And I like to think about a Hebraism kind of like today I think about idioms. You ever heard of an idiom? You know what an idiom is? An idiom is something, when said in your language, makes sense to you because it has a deeper meaning than the sum of the words. But if you took that phrase and put it in another language, at best, you just won't get the complete meaning. At worst, it means like nonsense, right? So I just wrote down some examples in my notes. Like, under the weather. You say that in another language, they're going to be like, aren't we always under the weather? I mean, you know, like, or at the drop of a hat. Again, we know what that means, but you say that in another language, it's like, what? You know, beat a dead horse. I mean, again, could you imagine a piece of cake, you know, for something that's easy. I'm like, what a piece of cake. Or spill the beans. When I was writing those down, I was thinking, I made a number of mission trips to Honduras, southern Honduras, working through a Spanish translator, doing evangelism. And I went 5 times, and several of those trips, I had others who went with me. And I've told this before, but I had others who went with me to do evangelism who had no experience speaking through translators. I have been fortunate. I have spoken through translators for years, different languages. And I would always tell them, one of the absolute no-nos in speaking through a translator is you cannot use idioms, idiomatic phrases, things that are just not going to make sense in another language. You can't do that because they're going to look at you like you're nuts, right? And I've told this story before, so if you've heard it, that's okay, because I want to hear it again. But I was studying with this lady, and we had two other men who were with me, and we were taking turns kind of studying with her. And there was, I mean, this is typical. You go into a house, Honduran house, which are, I mean, to our standards, would not even be considered a house. But you go in there, and there's usually a lot of people in there. And there was a lot of people in there. We're studying with this one lady. And she kept saying, come back tomorrow, come back tomorrow, come back tomorrow. Which, I mean, that's pretty common when you study with people. I'm not ready to make a commitment, I come back tomorrow. And one of my guys who was with me jumped in and said, today is the tomorrow that we talked about yesterday. And the translator looked at me, and I looked at the translator, and I just went like this. And so he translated it. And I promise you, there were people around the edge of the room who were going like this. They were going like this. It absolutely had no impact on her whatsoever because it didn't make any sense in Spanish. Okay? So, anyway, a Hebraism is not exactly like an idiom, but I just wanted you to understand the concept. Jews frequently spoke in absolutes when what they were trying to communicate was priority. Does that make sense? Priority, okay? They're trying to communicate priority. And so a lot of times when these Hebraisms are put into Greek, they become, and this is something my mentor, Dr. Marlon Conley, taught me when I was much younger, they become elliptical sentences. And you guys know what an ellipsis is? You see that in a sentence, it's like dot, dot, dot. What does that mean? There's something that goes in there, right? And what he would tell me was when you have these elliptical sentences, what is meant to be understood, it's not spelled out, but it's meant to be understood are the words only, merely, or chiefly. And so reread that first sentence in verse 3. Do not let your adorning be external, only, merely, chiefly. You with me? What does that mean? Don't let your priority be your external adornment. Okay, now, in case you think that that's just something, Tim, you're just making all this up because you don't want to tell people they can't wear jewelry and all that stuff, I want to show you something. This is that same verse in the New American Standard Bible. By the way, I use the ESV now. That's my primary translation. But for years, my primary Bible was the New American Standard Bible. Okay? Still love it. I love it as a translation. The translators, though, of the New American Standard Version, they will frequently insert words that they think are meant to be understood, and we'll put them in italics, okay? And this font does not support italics, but I want you to see what they put here. Your adornment must not be, you see what word they put in there? Merely external, okay? And because the translators believe that that was meant to be understood, okay? That was meant to be understood. Now, we don't have time to go through all the examples in Scripture of Hebraisms, but there's a lot because the New Testament was written primarily by Jews, right? There's a lot of Hebraisms. Guess who also spoke in Hebraisms? Jesus. Jesus. And I'm just going to give you one example. Again, we don't have time to go through them all, but this is in John chapter 6 in what we call the Bread of Life discourse. When Jesus has fed the 5,000 over on the east side of the Sea of Galilee, and then they all follow him back to Capernaum to the synagogue, and what are they looking for? They're looking for bread, right? They want more bread. Hey, we think we found the fountain of bread that's going to feed us for the rest of our lives. And so what does Jesus talk to them about? The bread of life, okay? In the midst of that, he says, do not work for the food that perishes. What happens if you do no work to be able to provide food for yourself or your family? You starve, right? You starve. So is that an absolute prohibition from working to provide food for you and your family? No, it's a Hebraism. It means that's not the priority. That cannot be the priority. And so you reread it as, do not work for the food that perishes only, merely, chiefly. Right? Jesus spoke in this a lot. Lay not up for yourselves treasures on earth. Does that mean you cannot have any possessions? What about passages that tell you to take care of your family? How can you do that with no possessions? Well, what's the emphasis? Lay up for yourself treasure in heaven. That's the priority, right? Doesn't mean you cannot have anything in this life. Otherwise, again, we'd all be naked, right? We have no clothing, right? We'd have no food to eat. We'd not be able to take care of our families. And so these are Hebraisms. Okay, or elliptical, you know, in the Greek, elliptical sentences. I hope that makes sense. Okay, I hope that makes sense. So, you take a step back and you go, what he's saying is, make sure the priority, wives, women, is on the internal adornment. This is not, you can have no external adornment at all. Okay, this is, the priority is on the inside. Okay, and I have a note there in between those two verses, or between verses 4 and 5, from 1 Samuel 16, verse 7, which is when Samuel was sent to the house of Jesse to anoint a king, the next king of Israel. And he kept going from the sons he thought were the ones that he was supposed to anoint, and it kept, God kept saying, no, 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 no. And what did God tell him? Man looks on the outward appearance, but the Lord looks on the heart. Don't be looking for the one that you think looks like a king. Follow what God has to say and look for the one who has the right heart, okay? David was a man after God's own heart. He's who was anointed, okay? Now, I want to look at this from another angle because it's context is critically important, and context sometimes is even beyond what's in the text. Sometimes context is cultural. Like, for example, when Peter says the braiding of hair, I mean, when I think of braiding of hair, I don't think of extravagance. I don't know about you. Like, in today's time, you see a girl who's got hair braided. Do you ever look at that and go, whoa? You know, I mean, that's not what that's like, right? That's not extravagance, okay? You have to understand, I've got this on the right, that in Roman society, that, I mean, extravagant steps for beautification were off the charts, okay? And so you had hairstyles like this. This is braiding in Roman Empire, 1st and 2nd century. The hairstyles were so tall, I've got this a note on the right, but the hairstyles were so tall, you have this famous satirist, Juvenal, in one of his books, he said, so important is the business of beautification, so numerous are the tears and stories piled upon another on her head. He's describing the hairdos to buildings. There's many stories and tears within the hair. And frequently they would have these huge hairstyles that were interwoven with gold and silver and jewels. And what was the purpose of that? The purpose of that was to be the center of attention. The purpose of that was to show, hey, I got a lot of money. I got a lot of money, right? I got a lot of money. So this is not, again, a girl wearing pigtails, right? This is extravagance. Here's another example. Again, of a Roman braided hair, okay? This is not what we think of today with braided hair, okay? So again, it's important to understand the context. Paul writes about the same thing in Timothy. You know, this is not, being in the body is not a fashion show, right? This is not, hey, everybody look at me, right? Sarah, I gotta tell this, I didn't give you a warning. Some of you saw, I posted some pictures of Sarah from her final day of homecoming with a pink wig, right? And every day of homecoming, they have a different theme that they dress like, and the final day was neon. And later that night after I saw her, she said, Daddy, I did not realize how much attention that would draw at school. You know, she walks in with pink hair, and it's like, everybody's like, whoa, what is that? You know, so in a different, I mean, not that that was extravagant, but this is the point. Like, this can't be, this is not how you adorn yourself to, one, to demonstrate your incredible wealth or to be the absolute center of attention, okay? Again, what's the priority? The priority is the inside. That doesn't mean that, like, that you can't wear clothing or that you can't, you know, in our terms, braid your hair, okay? It just means the priority has to be on the inside because that's all that matters, right? Okay, I hope that makes sense. I hope that makes sense. All right, let's keep going. So then he picks up in verse 5 and he says, he begins to look to the past. He says, this is how the holy women who hoped in God used to adorn themselves, by submitting to their own husbands. Meaning, this is not a new thing. The pattern of those who were followers of God is that the wives submitted to their husbands. And he gives the example as Sarah obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. And I have a reference there to Genesis 18:12. Where she referred to him as Lord. He says, you are her children if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening. A couple things there. One, You know, Paul frequently pointed to Abraham as our ancestor and that we are his descendants in the faith. And so it makes sense to me that Peter here in talking to women points to Sarah. Sarah, also included in the Hall of Fame of the Faithful in Hebrews 11 for her great faith, points to her and says, hey, she showed respect to her husband. She showed respect to her husband, so follow the example of Sarah. And then this phrase, if you do good and do not fear anything that is frightening, I think that possibly could mean your pagan husband. You know, live in such a way where you're not afraid of your pagan husband. Because what? Your future is secure. No matter what happens here, your future is secure. And so I think there's an encouragement here, okay? So I'm going to finish this out now talking about husbands. Husbands. And he says, likewise, husbands. And the likewise here is that, hey, husbands, before I move off onto the other next topic, you got responsibilities here too. You got responsibilities here too. Now, again, you look in some of the writings of Paul, and if you were to measure it in number of verses, the husbands get just as many verses as the wives, right? And the reason, again, I think the reason why the husband only gets one verse is because the situation is you're paired with basically a pagan spouse, and it's way more likely that that would be a wife than a husband, okay? But he's not going to let this go and move on to the next topic before he goes, hey, husbands, you got to remember, you got a role too. And he says, here's the role. Live with your wives in an understanding way. I read that. Be patient. Be patient. Be understanding. Be empathetic. Be empathetic. We have a tendency, meaning husbands, men, to only look at things from our perspective. And that's not great in a marriage, is it? But be empathetic. Be patient. Be understanding. Showing honor. Now, honor, again, he had talked earlier about showing honor to Gentiles, honor here to the wife. And as I've got on the right, Peter here is echoing the same sentiments of Paul in that husbands have a vital responsibility to the wives, which again was revolutionary in Greco-Roman society because in culture, the wives had no rights. I'm not saying that was the correct thing. That was a terrible thing. But he says, in a Christian household, you have responsibilities both directions. And he says, show honor to them as the weaker vessel. Just as an aside, I think this is just talking about physical strength. Not weaker in any other sense. Just as, you know, weaker physically. But he says, since they are. Now here I've summarized this on the left and the why. Why should husbands live in an understanding way with their wives? Be empathetic. Be patient. Why should they show honor to their wives? Number one is, you are fellow heirs. They are fellow heirs with you of the grace of life. You both, and this is assuming now that both husband and wife are followers of Christ. You're both fellow heirs. And this is a good time to remind ourselves that men and women, husbands and wives, they're equal in God's eyes. They're equal in God's eyes. You know, we've been studying Galatians on Wednesday night. One of those places where in Galatians 3 where Paul talks about us being descendants of Abraham and his faith. But just before that, we have the very famous verse in Galatians. There is neither Jew nor Greek. There is neither slave nor free. There is no male and female. You are all one in Christ Jesus. We're fellow heirs of God's grace. There's no distinction between any of us, even based on gender. Without Christ, we're all equally lost. And with Christ, we are all heirs of the grace of God. So we're one. It's a reminder, we're one. We're in this together. Husbands and wives, you're in this together. And the second thing is so that your prayer may not be hindered. And I'm going to tell you how I interpret that. On our counter in our kitchen, we have a little wooden plaque that says, Happy Wife, Happy Life. And we say that that is our family's mission statement. Because if mom's not happy, no one's happy, right? If mom's not happy, no one's happy. But the idea, though, is that if you have a chaotic household, I mean, things are a mess, right? I am, when things are not right with family, that's when my mind is the biggest mess. You can have the whole rest of the world's falling apart, but if family's okay, I can feel a sense of peace. And I think there's, hey, you're in a chaotic household, that is not a conducive environment to a healthy prayer life. Live in a peaceful family, peaceful situation, understanding, honor, respect, submission. Happy wife, happy life, right? Serving each other, mutual responsibilities, mutual responsibility. So, that's what Peter has to say about husbands and wives, and we'll move on. I'll be gone next week, but in a couple weeks we'll move on to the rest of chapter 3. But as we have invitation time, again, a reminder of what Peter had to say, that we're fellow heirs. We're heirs because we have received God's grace. Why have we received God's grace? Because Jesus died for all of us. And we have a choice. Are we going to accept that sacrifice or reject it? That same choice is available today. Are we going to accept it or reject it? If you've never made the choice to commit your life to Jesus, to be buried with him in baptism, what a great day to start a new relationship. To be fellow heirs with all of us who have already given our lives to Christ. If there's anything else we can do for you, if you're struggling, if you need prayers, if we can help you in any way, please come. I might lead us in our invitation song.